In keeping with tradition, we'd like to start this episode with an apology. You'll notice when listening to this episode that there's a lot of background noise for the first 25 or so minutes. We don't know why it is. We didn't change any settings, didn't do anything, and suddenly it changed to crystal clear quality. So all I can do is say sorry, and please, even though it might be poor quality, please listen to the first half of the episode, as there's some decent material in there, which we would appreciate your feedback on. Second half of the episode, like we said, crystal clear. So if you feel like fast forwarding to 25 minutes in, then do so. Thank you. Welcome to Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
And we're very happy that you've decided to join us, even though we've deserted you for the last few weeks. But with good cause, I might add, as we've been extremely busy doing lots of cases and helping the police with all their mountains of backlog. So thanks for your patience, and hopefully we won't disappoint this week. This is going to be... Unfortunately, we won't be doing another episode for a couple more weeks. That's because Simon is flying out to the US in just a couple of days' time, aren't you, Simon?
Yeah, this Saturday, so that'll be fun.
And do you want to share with us where you're going?
Well, initially, flying into and flying home from Vegas, but I'm actually going over to attend the Paraben Forensic Innovation Conference at Park City, Utah. And what? So that should be fun.
Okay, do you want to share what that's about?
Okay, well, Paraben are, I guess you could say they're one of the leaders in mobile phone forensic software. They're, I guess, having a trial, somewhat to speak of their own kind of conference. So we'll see what kind of things come out of that. There should be some interesting discussions on developments for forensics and mobile phones. So,
excellent.
See what happens.
Excellent. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about mobile phones today, and that's going to come a bit later. But first of all, we're going to talk about some of the news that has been going on the last couple of weeks. If we start with encryption keys, a couple of things have happened on that front. A recent change to the law in the UK means that suspects of crimes have to turn over encryption keys or be jailed. This is part of RIPA, or the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, and it goes along with a judgment made by a judge, I guess. And this case that this judge was a part of, he said that an encryption key was essentially the same as a key to a locked door or a house or a box or something like that. And so he says that if the police have a warrant to search your house, you know, they don't come to they come to the front door, and if it's locked, then you unlock it and let them in, otherwise they bash your door down. And so the same thing should be happening with encryption, was his interpretation. Is it's a virtual key to open a virtual box or drawer or whatever, that the suspects have to reveal that key or face up to 2 years in prison. Which is, to be honest, I found quite interesting, Simon.
Yeah, it's. I guess it's a judgment that kind of makes sense when you think about it. And it fits right into, I guess... It's kind of ideal for us, really, because more and more we're encountering things with our examinations where things are password protected, or we find encrypted volumes and things. So it is good news for people who work for law enforcement in the UK.
It is, but at the same time, I mean, just a few weeks ago, there was a case came to a head in the United States, and in this case... some guy had been stopped at the airport. He had had turned over his computers and everything to the TSA and whatnot. They went away and they investigated it, and they found that they couldn't get into some area of his computer because it was encrypted. And they said that you have to turn over your encryption key, and he refused. So it went to court, and the judge ruled that he shouldn't have to turn over the encryption key because it's basically it's incriminating himself. So, you know, two countries which share a lot in common seem to be at odds on this particular thing.
Yeah, it's strange how it can go one way in one country and the exact opposite can be said in another. I don't know, you're never sure how to really go about it. It might depend entirely on the situation as to whether it would be deemed to incriminate. It would be incriminating yourself or not.
No.
It could just be something where you keep a lot of your own financial records that you don't want people to see or something like that. And it's not necessarily anything to do with whatever you're accused of, but I guess if the evidence is starting to mount up and there's some key part of evidence missing and you suspect it might be in this encrypted volume, then it probably becomes more of an issue.
Yeah, it's just... I don't know, I think it's a bit odd because... on the one hand, you can see why the judge said, yes, it's a key just like any other key. Therefore, a warrant basically covers for all that and the person should give it up. And that's understandable, but it's also understandable from the other point of view where if you are guilty of doing something wrong and you don't want anybody to see the to see what's in that encrypted container, then why should you have to give it up? I mean, it's your own personal documents, so to speak, and therefore, you know, I don't know. It's peculiar and it's really really odd. The other interesting thing about this is that if we imagine someone who's got, you know, thousands and thousands of really really bad child porn files on his computer.
Mm-hmm.
He could get locked away for, you know, 10 years or so. But
yeah,
and if he's got it all in an encrypted file, and they say, "Give us your encrypted file," give us the key for the encrypted file, or we're going to send you to prison for 2 years. He's going to be like, "All right, I'll go to prison for 2 years,
yeah,
rather than 10." So,
yeah, it's the logical thing to do, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and you can see that there's a chance of that happening quite frequently. I mean, the arguments on both sides of this, you know, there's child protection agencies saying that there's not enough to coerce suspects into supplying encryption keys, saying that the 2 years in prison isn't enough, it needs to be higher. But then human rights organisations, they say that obviously it's in opposition to these people's human rights. And both sides have got very good, valid points.
Yeah, there's another issue to be mentioned there, and that's the fact that it's up to 2 years. So it could even be considerably less than that.
Yeah.
It would
take
quite... It's strange. Right? If I was in that situation, if I had a bunch of illegal stuff sat around in an encrypted volume, I would probably take my chances and not handing the password over. Because given the way that the judgment that came out of the US, I would fancy my chances and another judge thinking about it in a slightly different way to the last one.
Well, that's the thing as well, is that this was... this particular judge was at the Court of Appeal, which is... it's the highest court, essentially, you can go to before you go to the House of Lords, and then you've got the European courts as well. So this isn't by any means the top, one of the top judges who's made this decision. And therefore, it could be overturned further on down the line if an appeal is made.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I thought that was an interesting thing to start off with, a bit of controversy.
Yeah.
But something that's, The other side to this as well is that if you don't feel like giving up your encryption key, you don't have to stay in Britain. You can go elsewhere. Just make sure that elsewhere is not Turkey.
That's a good point.
CNET reported that Turkish authorities arrested a Ukrainian man in connection with large-scale identity fraud, including the stealing of people's credit card information, social security numbers, etc., etc., from all over the world. On his computer, large encrypted volume, and he said, "You can't have the password to that. That's going to incriminate me even further, so I'm keeping my mouth shut. You're not having anything." And it's been reported that this man was, allegedly, had the passkey beaten out of him by the Turkish authorities.
That's one way of doing it, isn't it, really?
I want your password. No. Ouch! All right.
How about now? Yeah, it doesn't really have much legal merit, does it, really, in this day and age?
Well, I don't know. I think it's not something to be laughed at, in all seriousness, saying it's quite terrible that someone would be treated like that, because, as we all know, you're innocent until you're proven guilty.
It's like the Jack Bauer approach to encryption keys, isn't it, really?
This potentially could cause a problem, because this man's going to be extradited to the United States, where he's going to face trial for all this.
Yep.
And if he stands trial in the US, the evidence that's come from the use of this encryption key, it could all be challenged, because it was...
It's never going to be admissible, is it, if that's how it's been obtained? Obviously, a lot of this is... It's coming from sort of news-type sources, so you can never be entirely sure. It's one side of a story. So I guess if we say allegedly in front of everything, that probably covers us. But I've forgotten what I was saying now. It's just gone out of my head.
Oh, well, it's not the first time it's happened. Let's face it.
I'm sure it's not the first time today. Yeah, but I think what I was getting at was there can't be any way that you force information out of someone and that it can be seen as being worthy to be used as evidence in court. It's going to be the first thing challenged.
Yeah, absolutely. And the sad thing is that there may have been other evidence around from other sources that could have quite seriously damaged this guy's credibility and got him locked up anyway, but the fact is that this is really going to cause a serious problem now.
Yep.
But, we'll see how that develops. At least he wasn't killed. That's the important thing. And
yeah.
Apparently, you can now be killed either virtually or physically, and either one will result in you receiving a prison sentence. Some Japanese woman was part of one of these virtual worlds, was married to this person in this virtual world, and come to find out next time she signed in that he just divorced her without any explanation why. Probably a much, much hotter looking avatar appeared on the scene or something like that. You know how these things go.
There's just no loyalty in these virtual worlds, is there?
No. People just... marriage is nothing but a sham for some of these people. It's just... honestly, first of all, why would you get married to somebody in a virtual world if you don't actually know them in real life? What? Anyway, beyond...
I've never really got into the whole virtual world thing, to be honest. I mean, there may be forensic merit to things like Second Life in the end of things, but I've never really... quite got into it. I've always thought, why not just live in the real world instead? But I might be on my own in thinking that.
No, I think there'll be plenty of people who side with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, you can be in a... I don't want to turn this into a rant or anything, but you could be in one of these virtual worlds and say, oh, look at this, I can be in this room talking to people. And you think, well, yeah, you could walk down your street and
talk to people
into some other room and talk to people. It's I don't get it. That and things like Big Brother. Why sit in your house watching people sat in the house? But anyway, getting off topic.
Graham, that was for you. So anyway, yeah, this woman, obviously feeling rather jilted, found out a way to completely erase this guy's character, this guy's avatar, so effectively killing him off.
Well, she logged into his account, didn't she?
Yeah.
And just deleted it from within his own account.
Yep. So.
And so that's where the problem really lies. It's not in the actual deletion of a character.
No. It's essentially it's computer misuse, isn't it? Or
yeah.
The equivalent of in Japan. And so, this woman, if found guilty in court, could face up to 5 years prison. Some people have argued that she shouldn't be serving this in a physical prison. But she her avatar should be locked up.
I think that's a great idea.
In a virtual prison on the virtual world. It seems only fair.
Let's make some sort of virtual Guantanamo or something.
If anybody comes in and spoils our virtual beach party, then we need to get the virtual police in and have them...
See, that's probably the only thing that would get me into a virtual world, is if I could go in and be virtual police. That'd be great.
You could just be a virtual terrorist instead. You could go around changing, you know, tearing people's houses down or planting bombs and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, like you said, these things are really strange, but I'm toying with the idea of doing something about something like Second Life. For my master's degree, for my dissertation for that. So, you know, I might be spending some time on Second Life to figure that out. And I don't think I'll be getting married to anyone on it, but still.
I think your wife would have something to say about that.
Let's do it. Other things which have happened recently is that the Computer Misuse Act in the UK has had a bit of an update. It's the Computer Misuse Act 2.0, apparently. They've made three specific changes. The first one is that they've changed the maximum penalty for unauthorised access to a computer system. This was originally 6 months, and those of you in the States are thinking, that is so low, how can it possibly only be 6 months? And it's been raised to 2 years, and I know that you're still screaming, what? That's so low. But unfortunately, that's what we deal with here. Our prisons are small and overcrowded. The second one is the denial of service attacks are now clearly criminal, when they've always been a bit of a legal grey area previously. And if you're found guilty of this, you can face a penalty of up to 10 years in prison. This was done because lots of private companies put lots of pressure on the government because of the old problems which they've been facing and whatnot over the years. And they needed a clear way in order to properly charge these people. And now they have it. The third change... is that it's an offence to distribute hacking tools for criminal purposes. Now, you may remember, it was like on our first or second episode, when we first discussed the possibility of this, was that the politicians originally, they wanted to get rid of all hacking tools for everyone, and no one was allowed to use them, which we mentioned at the time would have made our lives as forensic investigators in this country a little bit more difficult, not being able
to say the least.
Well, it was a stupid concept that it would have criminalised most forensic investigators throughout the country. Not that, you know, Somerset and Avon are trying to do that anyway, but
just squeeze that in there and then move on.
It was a joke. I didn't mean it. Dear, oh dear. I've been spending too much time on that forum, I think. No, but seriously. It could have done some serious damage. Thankfully, they've put that one bit in that says distributing hacking tools for criminal purposes. So if you're doing, if you're using them for your everyday computer forensics examinations, that's fine. That's not a problem. Also, this would exempt people like penetration testers and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, that's... The Computer Misuse Act has been in need of somewhat of a refresh for a very long time. It's been nearly 20 years since it was introduced.
Yeah, when you think of just the changes in computers in that time, it's obviously something that needs to be addressed.
Well, I mean, the original Act came out in 1990. Now, I don't know the exact statistics, but how many people even had the internet in 1990? How many people actually had home computers? There's a very, very small number of people.
Yep.
Must be. And so, lots of stuff has happened in that time, and unfortunately the lawmakers, it takes a long time to push a bill through, and they're not the most technically minded people either, and you have to wonder why they haven't actually done probably a bit more. I mean, it's a good start. We can say it's a good start for these revisions, but so much more could have been done. And especially with the sentencing. I mean, a maximum of 2 years for unauthorised access to a computer. It is somewhat of a joke, really, considering the damage that somebody could do.
Yeah.
If they get in. So, I don't know. It's crazy to me. But anyway, we got this. Some good news is Sleuthkit and Autopsy have got a new release. We won't talk about all the updates and stuff. All those updates are available on the website. You can go there and have a look at all that. And I'll post a link to that on the webpage whenever we put the podcast up. So, yeah. I don't think there's anything more to say on that, is there, Simon?
I haven't really had the chance to try out the new ones. I've been doing a lot of messing around with computers recently at home and haven't had the opportunity to install it and see what it's like. I mean, but hopefully I will do.
The update for Autopsy isn't that significant. It's gone up to 2.20 or something like that. But the Sleuthkit is a major release. So it's 3.0, I believe. So it is the next major release, and hopefully when people have had a chance to have a look at it, we'll find out exactly what you think of it. So, not much else to say about that. And then the last little piece of news is a new book is going to be released, which when Simon told me about this today, I was slightly stunned by it, but and lo and behold, it is true. What's this new book, Simon?
I merely heard it in passing in the office today, but apparently there's going to be a Computer Forensics for Dummies book coming out end of November.
Marvellous.
Yep. Someone obviously saw the market when this whole PI license business kicked up.
And here we go. Luby's going to get on his soapbox again.
I was just going to make that one comment and leave it at that.
I think that's the safe thing to do, yeah. He's actually said, if you go to Forensic Focus, it's one of the stories on there. And in the story, the author, who is a forensic investigator, has said that I've not made this for people who are going to investigate computers. It's just basically to make people aware of what forensic examiners do whenever they get hold of a computer, which is fair enough. I mean, we could always.
It's a good thing to do because there's a lot of people that don't know how to react when they find something illegal or when they suspect something. People will decide to copy a load of data over to a pen drive or try and burn something to disk or various other things when they should be informed that the first thing they should do is essentially isolate the data, turn something off or whatever if they can.
Yeah.
And contact a proper qualified forensic examiner.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard stories of people getting an email with child porn on it, so they printed it off and took it to the police. Not a good idea. Second of all, somebody, you know, someone fixing a computer finds child porn, indecent pictures of children again, and they call the police, and when the police turn up, they hand them a disc saying, "Here, I've copied all the stuff onto them so I can give the computer back to the client." And, you know, there's fun things like that happen quite a lot. So, yeah, in that regard, I agree. It's good. It's a good bit of exposure so people can know what to do if it comes to a crunch. There is another side to this that I would be a bit more concerned about, and that is that are we giving too much information about what we do and how we do it? Are we going to now see lots of people reading this book, you know, and saying, well, if that's how they're going to investigate my computer, then I'm going to do this to try and stop them from doing it? Are we going to see a rise in anti-forensics?
It's possible. A lot of things that people do in computer forensics, people can find out about online if they really wanted to.
Yeah.
People could sign up to forums. They could do what they could to discover our general workings and work around them that way. So it's nothing new. And if these people are really keen on hiding their activity, then chances are they're going to be quite savvy on the internet and know where to look for all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, I don't think a book along those lines will... I don't think it will really give enough information, to be honest. But, I don't think it will make much of a difference in that regard, but I guess it is a danger.
Yeah, all right. No, you know, I agree with you. I think that if someone really knows what they want to find in order to stop an investigation, they can do it quite easily. I just think it's a bit... like bringing it to people's attention more, that it is possible to stop us, and the privacy issues in regards to what information is left on their computer, whether they try to delete it or not.
Yeah. I think there is the other issue of people knowing how to circumvent forensic analysis in some way, but not actually using it out of convenience. I don't know how many times I've seen things like... wiping software and various other things that can be used to really cause a headache for a forensic examiner installed on computers but just not used because they take time to do. They just make things more difficult. And so I guess it's when people actually start using these tools when it will become a problem.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. No, I very much agree. All right, well... that's the end of the news portion. And I want to move on to a different topic. I mentioned at the top of the show that we're going to talk a little bit about phones and the like. There was an interesting study, or an interesting article, written by Nick Wingfield of the Wall Street Journal, saying that there's an increasing trend for people to leave their laptops behind and only to use their smartphones for conducting business on the road. The article references a couple of surveys. The first says that 3% of the average user said that they relied exclusively on their smartphone when they're out of the office. The second survey concentrated purely on iPhone users. And of that, of the people interviewed in that survey, 28% either strongly agreed, with a further 29% mildly agreeing, when asked if their phone was replacing the use of their laptops. So that's quite a lot of people, really. I mean, amongst iPhone users, you can kind of understand that a little bit. As the, well, they're fanboys, so.
Yeah.
Having said that, I want an iPhone.
Well, you say that, but you don't really, do you?
Well, I don't know.
You've still not made up your mind what you want.
No, that is very true.
Do you go for an iPhone, or do you go for one of these badged iPhone killers?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? But 57% of iPhone users said, I'm using my iPhone instead of a laptop.
Yep. And
I'm not sure if this is Apple's idea of a joke and they're trying to kill themselves off or or what. But I don't know. Lifehacker, they picked up this story and they've run a poll on their website. And when I last looked, just a little while ago, basically the poll said that half of the people who read this article said, yes, my phone, I use my phone instead of my computer. I use it for stuff that, you know, when I'm out and about and whatnot. And, you know, these are all figures which can't be ignored. You know, even though it's only 3% of the average user, and we're talking 57% of iPhone users and about 50% of geeks with smartphones, essentially.
Yeah.
But,
it is something that's, I think it's been coming for a while, though. I've thought for a few years that there would come a point where phones essentially meet computers. And, I think we're actually in that time now. And you look at the capabilities of things like the iPhone and some of the newer handsets that are coming out. And I look at the capabilities of my EPC laptop, and there's not a lot in it now.
No.
They can do a lot of the same sort of things natively.
Well, I recently scrapped my newer phone and gave it to my wife, and went back to using my old HTC Wizard phone, which is a Windows mobile phone. And I've now also been onto the service provider and said I'd like to have unlimited internet connection put on this as well, which I've done for an extra £7.50 a month with O2. And to be honest, I mean, I can now use that device for pretty much anything that I would typically do on my day-to-day use of my home computer.
And yeah, I guess it depends on exactly what you want to do. If you're going to be doing a lot of typing and things like that, then you will want a laptop to do it on, because you won't want to type on little on-screen keyboards or on the small thumb keyboards you get on devices like the HTC Wizard.
No, I agree with that. However, we also know that there are such things as Bluetooth keyboards.
Yeah.
And third-party pieces of hardware, which will plug into your Windows Mobile or possibly iPhone in the future, which you can just type into as if you're sitting at a normal computer. So, yeah, you're right, though. You're definitely right, because if you're going to sit down and you're going to write a novel, you're not going to do it on a smartphone, are you?
Unless you're really quite keen on writing it.
No, unless you want
to
be...
don't have anything else.
No, unless you want to be known for having done it on a smartphone, so people can brand you with geek on your forehead or something.
Which they probably would actually do.
Yes, quite possible. But I mean, you look at other factors for this as well. Okay, you look at the current marketplace and the economic climate, and people might look a $700 or $800 notebook computer and be like, you know what? I can't justify it. There's not really any point. And rather than do that, they'll take half the money or just a fraction of the money and say, oh, I'm just going to get a better phone, one that I can use to receive email, browse the internet, edit office documents on, something that's got built-in GPS, etc., etc. I mean, you mentioned the Apple iPhone. HTC have got a phone coming out soon that has the same resolution as your laptop does.
Yep.
You know, BlackBerry, they've got a whole bunch of decent phones now, including the Storm. And, you know, Nokia with the N95 and now upgraded to the N96. All these phones, 3G capable, or edge capable, can use it for all kinds of stuff. And people are starting to move away from their desktop and laptop computers, aren't they?
It's one of these things that I think is going to come full circle in some way. I think people will they'll move towards using smartphones and think, oh, aren't these things great? And then after a couple of years, they'll think, you know what? I kind of like having a proper keyboard again. I kind of like actually holding a computer. And I think we'll see people start to move back towards laptops and things again.
Well, I don't think that people ever move completely away from computers anyway.
No.
I mean, for personal use, or when you're out and about, then, it you know, a phone could quite easily do your job. I mean, all that I do when I'm at home, typically, with my computer, is browse the internet. Now, do I need a MacBook to do that? No. I can browse quite easily on a decent smartphone.
Yep.
But in the office, obviously, that's not practical at all. And not just for us, but for anyone, essentially. I mean, most jobs now require some computer to work on. But the main thing about all this, people might wonder, well, why the crap are you talking about smartphones? The reason that I bring it up is because with people tending to spend less money on computers, more money on phones, phones are becoming more advanced in their features and everything else. What impact is this going to have on digital forensics as a whole? I mean, my own personal view is that there's going to be certainly more work to be done on cellular and mobile phones. And do we have enough people to do this work?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's going to come to a point where people who are trained in mobile phone forensics may not be quite as well trained on smartphones, and so may have to do an entirely different set of training or whatever for that, because they do essentially work on a different kind of principle to your basic phone. But I don't know. I think there is always a crossover. There has been for many a year, and I think that there kind of always will be. It's just a question of whether you have a kind of generic forensic examiner in the end.
So you're saying that basically the skill set's going to have to be expanded for most forensic investigators?
It really depends on how far people want to go with it. I mean, you could obviously, as a forensic investigator or as a company, you can say, we will do computer forensics. But I don't think you'd ever be able to say, exclusively, we do phone forensics, because I think that's going to kind of bleed into the other area. So, I don't know, I think it really depends on how strict you are in defining what a phone is.
Well, there you go. That's the key, one of the key issues, isn't it? I mean, when do you get to the point where you say, right, we can no longer investigate this as a phone. We have to treat it more like a computer. I mean, do you just want to explain what you do for mobile phone investigations and what you submit in your report, for example?
All right. Well, generally speaking, the way we don't have all of the more recent mobile phone forensic software. Some of them have the capabilities of taking hex dumps and examining them, and we can do that for a lot of handsets anyway, but we generally don't need to go that far. It's like a last resort, essentially. Most of the standard forensic tools will take a logical extraction of the data on there, which you then compare to the data on the handset to make sure it's not missed anything. So essentially you combine this extracted information into a report. When there's a memory card involved, that's usually extracted. Our procedure is to extract that from the handset and to image it and analyze it in the same way that we would any kind of removable media in Encase or FTK or whatever we have to use for it. So there's kind of a crossover already, even before you even get as far as a smartphone. Because you can have a part computer forensic type investigation and a part phone forensic type investigation. You get into a lot of grey area once you start moving into things like iPhones, I guess.
Yeah, that's probably the key device that everyone's going to be thinking of at the moment. Because here we've got a device which it's capable of so much, but it's got a phone component to it. And so people would say, well, it's a phone, examine it like a phone. But this thing has got a BSD back end, essentially. It's a full operating system that's been crammed onto this thing.
Yep.
And a full operating system like that is going to leave special traces, as we've seen from Jonathan Jarski's presentation and his new book that he's released. It doesn't seem practical to examine this like a normal mobile phone. I mean, you can, if you crack this thing open, you jailbreak it, you can run terminal commands off it and stuff like that. You know, you can run compiled Linux programs and all kinds of stuff.
I don't really know quite how you'd address it, but I think there'll come a point where you decide how to examine it based on what it appears to have been used for. So if you got an iPhone in and someone had used it for making and receiving calls and text messages and email, and it doesn't look like they've done anything else, they haven't changed anything, or done anything radical with it, you might think, okay, well, that would class as a phone investigation, whereas you could get the same model of phone in. And if someone's used it for all of the above and have used it for an awful lot of internet activity, then you might want to class it as something else. And so it's. I don't think there's a definite answer to this kind of thing yet. I don't think anyone's really come up with a set of guidelines on how to identify what type of handset should be classed as what.
No.
I mean, but I think it will need clarifying at some point in the future.
So are you essentially saying that these devices fall into some kind of void which hasn't been properly picked up yet? We need to come up with some kind of new methodology for it.
Yeah, I think probably for the most part, that's only really important when you come to things like, as far as companies are involved, for billing for things. So what to charge, what kind of examination to charge someone for. But it will become more and more important as we see more of these types of phones come out. I think they will possibly end up creating their own kind of forensic category.
Yeah, it seems really interesting because, I mean, if you take the V3 Razr, for example, okay? Mm-hmm. It's the most popular phone in the world at the moment. And what does it do? I mean, it does, in terms of what these smartphones are capable of, it does very, very little. And a forensic examination of a V3 Razr, you could probably sort out in, you know, an hour or so.
In theory, yes. Yeah. They're not the most forensic-friendly phones.
No, but in theory. But
yep.
These things have got limited storage on. They've, you know, limited internet connectivity.
And most of the models don't allow you to add a memory card, so it just makes it fairly basic.
Yeah, so you're looking at calls and things taken with the camera, pictures taken with the camera, essentially.
Pretty much.
And that's simple, but it's just... Sticking that into the same category as something like an iPhone or an HTC Touch Diamond or HD, all, you know, there just seems to be something just inherently wrong with that, doesn't there?
Yeah, well, you can even go back further than that to things more basic than the V3. I mean, we've had Nokias in that are several years old, and basically they send and receive text messages, they make and receive phone calls, and do pretty much nothing else.
No.
And you look at that, and you look at a modern HTC handset, and you think, how can you put these in the same category?
No.
And the answer is, in a lot of practical applications, you can't really.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma, this. It's something that I'd like to hear more about from other people, to be honest, as well. I mean, has anyone else out there done anything in order to combat this? You know, do you have special procedures in place where if you receive particular types of phone that you set them aside to do a different type of investigation on, and so on and so forth?
I'd like to know if there's anyone out there that considers himself a specialist in examining these types of phones.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that could be quite interesting to know if they have seen any vast differences in the way that standard handsets are done in comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an interesting topic. Especially when people are pouring their entire lives into phones now, rather than just using them for making and receiving basic calls.
Yeah, people are starting to use the facilities of their phones more. I mean, there have been a lot of phones in recent years that, I don't know how many people are aware of the fact that their phone will more than likely have a calendar on it, some kind of scheduler, a facility for taking notes and tasks and reminders and all these kind of things. A lot of people probably don't even know that these functions are on their phone, and they're on so many of them that you don't even really know they're there.
No.
But people are actually, once they're made obvious and they're made easier to use, people are using these functions more and more.
One of the main features that I think is going to be of significant interest to forensic investigators is that there's a lot of phones coming out now with GPS on it. Now, GPS units themselves can be a real absolute pain in the neck to analyse and to perform investigations on. And there's a few people who've done research into this. Richard Drinkwater from Cheshire Police. He's got a blog, Forensics from the Sausage Factory, .blogspot.com. It's an unusual title, but you'll understand when you read the blog. But every single post, but you know, every other post essentially is this GPS device does this, and he's done investigations into it. So it's worth checking that out if you've got GPS stuff on. But on these phones, like for example, if you go onto iTunes and you look at the navigation section of the App Store, there's loads of them. I mean, the GPS is so integrated into how this phone functions that saying that you're just going to pull off the phone calls and the pictures and everything else just does not do it justice. I mean, the GPS can be used to geotag pictures, first of all. For those of you who don't know what geotagging is, essentially you put the coordinates, the GPS coordinates of where you're taking the picture, embedded into the picture. You've got things which track you while you're running. You've got things which will send out distress beacons if you standing still in an area for any amount of time. You got just immense number of different things. All these location-aware applications that they can... Don't get me wrong, these things are an absolute goldmine if you're investigating, but it can also be something which, unless you have a proper methodology in place, you're not going to see. You're not going to understand. And we run the risk of, if we don't understand how these devices work, if we don't understand what they're really capable of, that we miss things. And
yep.
It's just, I don't know. I don't have an answer to it. And I'd love to hear if anybody else does, to be honest.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think the company that we work for is probably going to have to address in the near future, because some standard handsets, as you say, can be examined in a matter of hours, whereas some of the more complex, newer phones can take, they can take days sometimes. And so it's things that you need to look at and examine, and I guess things change constantly.
Yeah.
And keeping on top of it's the same in all of forensics. As soon as you get familiar with the latest Windows operating system and the various artifacts, there'll be a new Windows operating system out, and the artifacts will have, hopefully for forensic investigators, changed entirely. Things change, and it's just a case of keeping up date and making sure that you don't get left behind with things.
No. Absolutely. And like we said, if anybody has any thoughts or ideas on this, then please leave a comment on the website for the posting of this podcast, or you can even make use of the forum, which now has five Good. Members, I think. Dizzy heights.
What we've got to do is double that and we'll be in double figures.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, is our first double figure episode. Amazing. I already said that, didn't I?
Nah. I don't remember.
I'm getting old. I'm 30. All right.
You're not that far off. Three digits. Okay, you're way off.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, mentally, I'm still in single digits.
Amen to that.
All right. Well, I think we've laboured that point enough. We don't want to bore people to tears or anything. So, Simon, any interesting stories, funny stories for us?
Yeah, well, we've been discussing mobile phones, and I guess there's something you'd put into the do's and don'ts categories for what happens when things go wrong with your mobile phone. This is to do with a report in the Daily Telegraph, and a mistake by a Frenchman on a TGV train. Essentially, if you drop your phone into one of these toilets on a train, you probably shouldn't put your hand in after it. This man did. He caused a 2-hour train delay when his arm got stuck down a toilet trying to retrieve his phone. He put his hand down there after obviously the phone slipped out, but because of the suction of the various parts of the toilet, he wasn't able to get his arm back out again. And so,
a 2-hour delay.
Yeah, in this high-speed TGV train from Paris to La Rochelle, which I've probably massacred in the way I pronounced it. But anyway, firefighters were called to the scene. It took more than an hour to free the man from his predicament. And in fact, before lifting him from the train, he actually still had the entire toilet stuck to his arm.
Did he get his phone back?
I don't think it actually says. Let's see. A fire spokesman said he was cut free from the toilet on the platform, and apart from suffering bruising and smelling a bit, he suffered no other injuries. It doesn't actually say whether he got his phone back. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If you find it, I'm sure that that someone would be interested to get it back. They went through a lot of hassle to stop it going missing in the first place.
Oh, imagine he's on a phone call sitting on the toilet, which is a stupid thing to do anyway. Who wants to talk to you when you're sitting on the can? I don't understand. Exactly. But then you can imagine he's dropped it while the call's still on. So he's like, oh, crap. Bill's going to be huge.
Yeah, there's that. I think it's... I doubt he would have been on the phone at the time. More likely than not, people keep things in the top pocket. They lean over and it falls in, don't they? I mean, I've known a couple of people that have done that with their phones.
Right, fair enough. That's funny nonetheless.
Yeah.
Ah, dear. Good stuff. All right, well, like we said at the start, Simon is going to be away for a couple of weeks now, so when he gets back, I'm sure I'll have lots of things to talk about, so hopefully we'll do another episode then. Aside from that, I've got no other news or announcements. Have you, Simon?
No, you didn't get very far with the guest presenter then.
Guest. Well, a couple of people have said they would do it, but I've just thought that with the amount of news and the speed with which news appears in this particular field, a couple of weeks between an episode, between two episodes, isn't going to kill it off.
Yeah.
Unless somebody wants to make some news, which feel free to do. Discover something.
Yeah, or write some new bit of software or something.
Yeah. And that way we'll have something to discuss.
Ooh, it'd be good if we could get an exclusive on something.
Oh, yes. Another Mark McKinnon, please. Yeah. So, yeah, we've still got some guests which we plan on having on the show at some point. Harlan is still... I assume he's busy writing the second edition of his Windows Forensics book. So, hopefully we'll get his thoughts and feelings on some stuff some point in the future. Yeah, that's all I got. So
yeah, I don't have much to add to that, really.
Okay.
Other than to say I'll be doing what I can to record anything. Well, not obviously literally record anything, but keep a record of things I learn over the next couple of weeks, and I'll share anything useful.
If anybody is going to be in Park City, Utah, for this conference, and they see, a skinny 6-footer with short hair and glasses walking around.
That's probably going to narrow it down a lot.
I was just going to say, you're probably in the right place. But yeah, with a British accent, it could be Simon. So go say hello, and make yourselves known. We'd always like to hear from people anyway.
I'd love to hear if people are going there that actually listen to the podcast. So if anyone does happen to see me or whatever, then that would be quite interesting to talk to someone who actually listens to it.
Yep. Fantastic. Yeah, I think that's all. Thank you for listening. And we shall bid you adieu.
So, okay, and in the in language of the 21st century, goodbye.
All right, goodbye.